The New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with Harlem Nocturne. Of course, you know that was a wonderful classic by the great Duke Ellington, featuring Fred Ryder on that growling saxophone. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Friday, March the 8th, and we're closing out the week with a couple of news items and a salute. Well, a special kind of commentary on the occasion of International Women's Day. So let's see what the news items are. Let's see. Oh, unemployment figures are out. February, the jobs inched up a little bit to 236,000 new jobs, bringing down the unemployment rate of 7.9% to 7.7%. But there are still 12 million people unemployed, and even those who are in part-time jobs or have left the job market altogether are not entirely sure that they would land a job next month. So, what do you think is interesting about this? What's interesting is the job rate was the same or worse for every racial category but one. Only whites saw an increase in employment. The rates for teenagers is 25.1%. The rates for African Americans, 13.8%. Latinos, 9.6%. And the jobless rate for Asians showed no change at all from year over year at 6.1%. And this is interesting. Again, the figures are suggesting we have an issue with race in America. It is consistent and we talk about it, but nothing is done about it. And those figures are, by the way, very conservative. You know, when you talk about a 25% unemployment rate among teenagers, there are places in the black community where this would be a godsend. If only we could have 25%. But in fact, the unemployment rate among teenagers is three times and more than 25.1%. A somber mood gripped Venezuela today as funeral services were held for its late president, Hugo Chavez. Later today, Nicolas Maduro, who was designated by Chavez as his vice president, officially will be named president, and elections will be called within 30 days. More than 30 heads of state attended the funeral, including leaders anathema to the United States. And I'm referring specifically to Cuba's Raul Castro, Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Belarus's Alexander Lukashenko. Congressman Gregory Meeks, of New York, and former Congressman William Delahunt of Massachusetts represented the United States at the funeral. And interesting, we'll get back to that. Chavez, who led Venezuela for 14 years, died Tuesday, as you know, at the age of 58, after a long battle with cancer. He will lie in state for 7 extra days because nationals insisted on seeing him before he goes anywhere else. And the anywhere else is already planned, according to government officials. The body is to be embalmed and kept in a glass casket, much like Ho Chi Minh, Lenin, and Mao. At least that's what the soon-to-be President Maduro already has said. A son-in-law of Osama bin Laden has pleaded not guilty at his arraignment in federal court today on charges he conspired to kill Americans. Suleiman Abu Gait, who the government says appears in videos representing al-Qaeda after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, was arrested in Turkey and brought to New York City to stand trial. After being captured in Turkey, he was deported to Jordan and secretly brought to the United States in an operation led by the Jordanian authorities and the FBI. He is said to be the highest-ranking al-Qaeda figure to be brought to the United States to face a civilian trial. But already we have objections, and they come from two members of the Senate, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who say that there appears to be a lack of wartime detention policy since the defendant has been brought to New York as opposed to a military installation, and they're referring specifically to Guantanamo Bay, where typically combatants, as they call them, are supposed to be taken and tried. And in the case of Lindsey Graham, he said that bringing Abu Ghraib to the courts in New York now jeopardizes the safety of Americans. So we'll know more about this. I had a look at the indictment. It's 7 pages long and necessarily vague. So you would see that the charges do sound quite vague. They are actually very vague in the indictment itself, and that is typical of an indictment of this type, when, in fact, they will put in the specifics as close as possible, closely as possible to the trial. And we'll know more about that. Well, on this day, it's International Women's Day. Which country do you think is the best place to be a woman? The World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Report says it is, are you ready? Iceland, followed by Finland, Norway, and Sweden. Of 135 countries it rated, the United States ranked 22nd on the list of places where it is the best to be a woman. And I think they were talking specifically about women's places in politics. Well, I want to make my own little statement about women's rights and in observance of International Women's Day. And I have my own thoughts about that. I've always had my own thoughts about these kinds of things. And as I thought about it, you know, I thought about my mother and people who were like my mother growing up in the town I grew up in. These were fierce women. They didn't make a big fuss about anything. And they took care of business. Very quiet, very persevering, very dignified. You know, and they went about the business of waging what I call a quiet revolution. And their revolution was the revolution of family. Solid family. And they took great pride in devoting themselves to the well-being and the welfare of everyone in their charge, from the husband on down to the dog. Everybody was taken care of. I don't generally talk about my own private situation, but I was thinking about my own mother a lot. And my mother was a businesswoman, but her first priority always was her children and her husband. She let nothing come in the way, ever, 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 ever. And yet she was very calm, very quiet, very contained, very polite, ladylike. Never, ever did I hear her raise her voice, ever. And yet everybody knew who the boss was in the household. Everybody knew it. My father was a big old strapping man, boisterous and loud and gregarious, and he's out there. If he's in the room, everybody knows he's in the room. My mother was the polar opposite. And as big and as bad as he was, when Gertrude says, "I don't think so," that's the end of the conversation. You ask my mother something and she says, "I don't think so." That's it. Don't even pursue the matter any further. It is just not going to work. Don't try it. Don't even attempt it. A couple of hours down the road, it is not going to change. She was very resolute in that way. And yet, very, very nurturing. And very typical, I must say. Very typical of the women in my little village in Trinidad, where I was born and raised. There was a woman, I'll just call her Mrs. M, who was unusually prolific in her reproduction. You know, she had, at least I remember her having about 24 kids, several sets of twins. And although in this little area that we lived in, this little town, the women didn't really socialize with each other. They didn't have a habit of dropping by just to say hello. They never did that kind of thing. But on any given Friday or Thursday or Saturday, boxes of things would suddenly just show up at Mrs. M's door from other women who didn't have to be asked whether she needed help. Everybody knew when you had 24 kids, you need help. When it reaches a point when you have to have a bus to go visit relatives, you know you need help. So the women in the town just did it. They didn't ask whether she needed this or she needed that. Everybody did what they could, without even organizing it. It was just a natural tendency to look out, because they related to the fact that they had a lot of kids and Mrs. M had a heck of a lot more, but it was about a mother responding to another mother. And they did that until we left the town and lived elsewhere. Every Friday, it was understood. There are things going down to Mrs. M. The boys will have to take it. I grew up in a household that was dominated. It was just overladen with testosterone. There were 8 men in my house. 8. I only have one sister, but 8 of the other species lived in the household. And I had often been told that I grew up with a kind of practicality that people associate with men. that I never really think like, quote, a woman. I don't even know what a woman thinks like. But I could tell you that I've always been straightforward with things, you know, and I try to be as logical and as practical as I possibly can. And then I came to the United States and ran into a whole different cultural mindset. And the one that stuck with me the most was the apparent war that was going on between women and men. I didn't understand that. I didn't get it for quite a while. I didn't get overt racism either until, of course, I put the pieces together and realized that I had always lived in a racist society because Trinidad is a colony of Britain. And by definition, it was subjugated to racism as a result of being colonized by Britain. We did not share, as in South Africa, the same landmass as our oppressors. I mean, we didn't see them every day, but we were governed by proxy, some as colonies are. Britain was it made a fantastic science of it. How do you rule by proxy? And you rule by proxy by creating artificial societies. And you imbue these artificial societies with a sense that whatever it was that they used to be is no longer viable or valid. And they should subscribe to this bastardized version of what being British means, or in the case of the Spanish, what being Spanish means, or what being Belgian or Dutch means, depending on who laid claim to your country. You were imbued with values that are literally antithetical to your own survival and mental health. But that's how colonialism is. But in the United States, it took on an interesting double life. There was a life that you lived when you retreated to a safe place where you could be yourself. And then when you went into that space where you had to be somebody else, and the somebody else you had to be was, you know, at that time unfolding. It was a time of the change of identity and an increased consciousness about being Black. And being Black as a universal narrative for people of African ancestry. And it rang true because, although in Trinidad growing up, it was not part of the narrative. Really, it really wasn't, because it's a very mixed up place racially. And the struggle was not so much ethnic. The struggle was political, socio-political. We were British subjects. And our reference point for everything good was British. You know, after a while, you see how the schizophrenic existence actually played out in your life. Imagine I'm a little girl in a little town, and we had to go to the basement of the school where there was this one little room where we would all gather to listen to the BBC World Service. Oh, that was a big thing, Wednesday morning. And we were listening to British people teaching us about our culture through their eyes. It was really fascinating. And it extended into high school, where I'm actually taught a song by Jan Bonnie Bank and by Jan Bonnie Bray. We had to roll the R's to sound like we're Scottish. By Jan Bonnie Bank and by Jan Bonnie Bray, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond. Huh? Well, anyway. So I came to the United States, and immediately I learned that there are new rules. And I got to learn these rules because it was so entirely different from my own socialization. And that was why I thank my mom and my dad, because although they did not do this in a political sense, they knew, as many people living in a colony would know, that your future actually depended on you leaving the country. Because it's typical of all colonial countries that what you most desperately need to fulfill your life's dreams is going to be markedly absent. The colony, after all, is viewed as a means of production for the things, the services they want, and therefore education is not necessary, so we didn't have a university. Medical care and quality of life, these things were not important to colonizers. So they didn't exist. So if you had any ambition to be anything, it was understood at some point you will have to leave the country. And I'm looking across the table from a woman, a white woman, and we're talking, and she's evaluating my educational experience. And we're talking. We had to have been talking for at least a good 20 minutes. And she asks me, "Do you speak English?" I kid you not. And I said, "Lord, please help me. I am in the hands of an idiot. And this idiot will have control over my life because I'm being evaluated in order to attend college." And it was her evaluation that I was too young to go to college. Boom. Future toyed with. Short-circuited by a person with whom I had been having a very good conversation, who decided for some reason I was not speaking English. Wow. I ran through many skirmishes, typical of immigrants. You run through these skirmishes, I call them, because they are injuries to your soul, inflicted because the person or persons doing it understand they have a greater advantage over you. It's an American immigrant story. But I'm coming to the part about women and why I'm automatically suspicious about the women's movement. It may sound a little harsh, but it's true. I have found more difficulty. I've encountered more difficulty dealing with women, American women, than with any other specific grouping of people. I'll give you an example. I was in a position of authority at a radio station, which will not be named. I didn't ask for it. In fact, the workers themselves said they voted for me to be in a position of authority. I didn't even run. I didn't know it was an election, anything. But they said, "You're it. We want you to help us fix things." And then it came to be that a woman of authority at the head of this enterprise said, "We need you to do this. We need you to take charge and fix things because they're very, very, in a very bad way. Will you do it?" I said, "Well, I don't know. If you want me to, I will. But, you know, is that what you want?" "Yes, that's what you want." Immediately, a story went out that was the most vicious lie anybody could ever hear. By a woman. About how the station was going to be sold and all kinds of hell and damnation and what a monstrous thing. Now, up until that point, I was fantastic. Okay, fantastic. But when it came to making decisions that were prudent, a white woman stepped forward and said all kinds of things that were just absolute, the worst kinds of lies. The black women never bothered to even talk to me, to this day, not even a phone call. Then the white woman made a claim. Everybody said, that's the story. And she's absolutely right. Okay. That's, you choose to believe that it's all right by me. I have no problem if that's what you choose to believe. Of course, there was a plan. And the plan was that in the midst of all the confusion, you can get a lot of things done that nobody would stop and really evaluate and say, well, wait a minute, this is underhanded, or this is illegal, or this is theft, or this is an absolute betrayal of the spirit of community or communal leadership. And so the attacks, they were vicious, they were mean, they were awful. People physically attacking me, people physically trying to get into my house, people firing shots into the house of my boss, who had to separate her children, her twins, in order to secure their safety. And these were women starting this, starting these rumors, starting this fight. Nobody ever questioned the veracity of the person making all these claims. She's a white woman, therefore she's credible. She's a white woman, therefore she's correct. She's a white woman, therefore she can do what she wishes. I'm right there. And nobody would ask me, well, what is the truth of what is happening here? And these are empowered women. These are revolutionary women. These are women who would call you sister. with their natural hair and processed minds. So it brought to me my entire experience where it's not so much on the basis of gender that one suffers or one is set upon. It is the basis primarily of race. Yes, I recognize that and I believe that. We have a lot to do, including in the so-called progressive communities, the so-called liberal communities. Trenchant racists exist. They don't have the guts to be honest or forthright or correct in their dealings with others. They don't have it. A woman to be is a person who is, you say what you mean what you say. You come straight to the point. But I have seen more women carve up other women like, I mean, you wonder what claim could they possibly have to be progressive and to be about women's rights? What claim could you possibly have to that? You have no character. You have no honesty about you. You have no standards, except insofar as you can prevail in your narrow-minded agendas. And you will act just like any white man to get where you want to go. You will step on anybody. You will destroy anything or anybody who steps in the way of your private program. It is not accidental that that institution is suffering the way it is suffering. When I went there, it was under the management of a sister, a black woman, who refused to pay me for almost 3 years. Refused to pay me for almost 3 years. Of course, I went there because my good friend and buddy and comrade in arms, Samori Marksman, asked me to come to help. And I was delighted to do it. He was a very principled guy. I liked him very much. But progressives treat each other like that. They have staffs that are doing yeoman services for no pay, and yet you can champion the rights of workers. Working in a filthy environment, and yet you champion the workplace environment. You're talking all about what's going on in these countries and people who are slave labor. You have slave labor right in your face, and you're not addressing it. Because most of these people doing this, suffering like this, were black. My major crime of mine was, hey, this has got to change. And as manager, I brought in the industry union. Even the union guy said, this has never happened before, so what's going to happen now? I brought in the union as the manager. I'm very proud of that. I cleaned up the joint. I put order in the place. Established standards, because people require us to have standards. Our community depends on it. So I'm saying this to say, I'm not fooled by any and everybody coming up to me and telling me how devoted they are to women's rights. Yeah, well, okay, sure. I'll see what your character says, if you could be championing anybody's rights at all. I do not have a hatred of men, which many people seem to think is a requirement for women's rights. You have to be, for women's rights, you have to be anti-men. It's like saying, being for rights as an African-American, you have to be anti-European. No, you're just affirming the rights of people who have been marginalized. Frederick Douglass was one of the greatest feminists in this country. And he went around and advocated for women's suffrage. He said, in fact, it was on the masthead of his newspaper, the North Star. He said, if because people are black, they are therefore slaves, if that is the thinking, can we not see the extended logic of that, that if women can't vote, then we can't claim to be a democracy? Oh, it went over really well. In fact, I would say that in a very real way, had it not been for Frederick Douglass, the resolution to pursue women's suffrage would never have occurred, because it was his speech in Seneca Falls in 1848 at the Women's Conference, the first Women's Conference, where, by the way, he was the only black person there and the only male. And he's preaching to these women, you have to assert your right to vote. They initially said, no, we don't want it. We want to deal with other things, but we're not ready to deal with this right now. It was only after his speech that they said, okay, we'll vote. And do you know, after the vote, when Douglas decided, well, okay, I have aided you. I've gone all over the place, gone even to Europe to tout your cause. Let's talk about black people and the rights for blacks. Nick said, Fred, could you come over here for a minute? Let's have a little chat. We really didn't see ourselves doing that, you know. I don't think the country is ready. They never did. So I see these contradictions. When the women's movement was in its fullness, you know, and there's all this talk about the white patriarchy, white male-dominated society, well, good. I acceded to that reality or that social experience. It was not mine, so I never claimed it. It was not my experience. My experience was different, shaped by a colonial structure, and then shaped again by the American reality of race and class, not gender, you see? And then I get into these discussions with women, and there is this insistence that I see the world the way they do. And again, that's part of the fallout of racism. If you don't see the world the way I do, then you can't possibly be my equal. You know, I disagree with you, therefore you're my inferior. But we have a different story to tell. My community, the community I come from, doesn't need any more fractionalism. It needs amending. We don't need to see ourselves as separate from men. We need to see ourselves as integrated and push for that, to see ourselves as integrated into a community that is all treated alike. We all suffer the same way. I don't suffer more as a black woman in America than does a black man for me, in my position is. Primarily, I experience a great deal of resistance, not to my being female at all. Generally, it is with the complexion of my skin and the assumptions that go along with that. I've told you about going to this interview. They asked me to come to the interview to talk to me about heading up a magazine. And then the woman tells me I'm so frightening because I'm able to have an intelligent conversation off the cuff. You know, that was, I still remember that. What she was telling me was she was not relating to me as another sister. You know, this wasn't a sisterhood at work. This was racism at work. And going back to that other situation, to this day, no one has ever questioned the veracity of the person, the main person who led this charge, and were willing to tear up the station, tear it down, destroy it, simply because it could not be controlled singularly by her. This is the person who authored the entire program of terror. And they swear to you that they're progressive. They swear to you that they're for women's rights. They swear to you how radical they are. But I have encountered that phenomenon so many times. So I dismiss it. It means little or nothing to me. Women's rights to me are different, on a one-on-one. I have many, many, many women friends. But they tend to have a singular characteristic about them, and that is they're good people. They're not fair-weather people. They're not fakes and frauds and phonies. They're solid. It's not about glory. It's about work in service of others, not in service of oneself. It is about honoring the integrity of your personhood and honoring the personhood of every person you meet. In the end, women's rights would be meaningful when we see it as an integral part of the main aspects of their lives. But you look and you see the psychological damage that is, it runs right through their lives. They have men in their lives who are messed up. They have messed up kids. They themselves are messed up. Because the psychology internalized is one that is fundamentally self-annihilating. I would work, and I still do work, in healing our community. I'm talking now about the African-American community, particularly, where the sum total of a woman is a degree to which she wages that quiet revolution of contributing the best of herself to those in her charge. It's not by any means a servile thing. It is so revolutionary that you really have to be committed to do it. It is not about trophies and plaques and being popular. It is about being the genuine article. I wish every day that I could be more and more like my mother. Quiet, determined, true, caring, loving, generous, compassionate, sweet, steady, intuitive, non-combative, intelligent, loving, and kind. And imbuing those around her with the very best of those qualities and encouraging them to develop the very best of themselves. That's the quiet revolution. We don't have enough of that. My mother was, as I said, a businesswoman. My father owned businesses of his own. And I remember that my father would go take a shower. And we're in Trinidad, of course, we don't have towel warmers. My father took a shower. My mother, wherever she was, she'd just leave it. And there she would be ironing the towel. And we thought that was the most hysterical thing we'd ever seen. We used to laugh at it. Ironing a towel? Are you serious? And it really was that she was making it warm. She wanted that whenever my father took a shower, he would have a nice warm towel to dry off with. Now, some people would say, my God, that is so servile. It really isn't. It really isn't. This was what she saw as her priority. Making her husband and her children happy. And being a part of their evolution as good people. Very good people. So, that's what I wish for myself and for women generally, to just become the very best person and to reject anything that smacks of hate and jealousy and a desperate need to draw attention to yourself and miserliness and counting, you know, mad that the world may have more than you do or maybe smarter than you are. Get rid of all the negatives and go about the business of doing revolution every day. Bring somebody along. Teach them what you know. Give them a word of encouragement. Put them on the path to where it is they want to go, not where you want them to go. Help them genuinely with no strings attached. Don't cause friction. Don't lie and tear people's character apart for the sake of your own sense of security. Don't damage people. Don't split people up. Don't walk around angry all the time thinking that that's what makes you a woman because you can hate men. It ain't about that. I got a note just yesterday from a woman I knew at BAI. For a long time we hadn't been in touch, and she wrote me this very touching note that her husband of 40-odd years had died in the interim, and how she was mourning. And I said, you are a very lucky person to have had the best of another person for all those years. He was waging a perfect revolution. He selected you and gave you the best of himself for 40-odd years. And you never had to question his veracity or his character in 40-odd years. What a gift you have had. Live with that. Celebrate that. Be thankful for that. And relate to other people with that in mind, that you owe it to him to act just the way he acted towards you. And she wrote me back. She said, thanks. So those are my words today. That's what's on my mind. Resist the politics of hate and separation and envy and lust for annihilation. Avoid people who come to you pretending to be something and they are not. Wage your own quiet revolution. Thanks for listening to me today. I enjoyed it. I hope it's meaningful to you. And we'll see each other on Monday. Thank you. Thanks and thanks. We'll be right back.